This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might not recognize Daryl Hammond if you ran into him on the street because he's more familiar in character as Bill Clinton, Al Gore, John McCain, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Donald Trump, and Sean Connery. Those are just some of the characters Daryl Hammond was famous for on Saturday Night Live, where he was a cast member for 14 seasons, which set a record for longevity. He's written a new memoir that really threw me. It's called God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Effed. And in the first page, he describes being sent to a psychiatric and rehab facility after getting drunk and trying to cut his arm off with a kitchen knife. As the book goes on, he describes being the victim of his mother's emotional and physical abuse and suffering mental health problems. As you can imagine, some of this conversation may be upsetting for some listeners to hear. In a couple of minutes, we'll hear what happened backstage just before this sketch when Hammond did his now famous impression of Al Gore in his first debate with George Bush. He's talking about the Bush tax cut plan.
My plan, Jim, is different. Rather than squander the surplus on a risky tax cut for the wealthy, I would put it in what I call a lockbox.
Daryl Hammond, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, reading your book, I kept thinking to myself, I've seen you so many times on TV. I had like no idea that you were going through such agony and that you were having, you know, the mental health problems that you were having and the alcohol and drug problems that you were having. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to let us know about all of this?
Well, I think I've been fascinated for as long as I've been alive, and that's a few years now, about relationships between perpetrator and victim and the contract between perpetrator and victim, the agreement between perpetrator and victim in which the victim agrees to remain silent because he's in fear. And so I wanted to write about it. Maybe I didn't write well about it, but I wrote about it, and that's what's in this book.
When you refer to yourself as the victim, mm-hmm. do you mean victim of your mother?
Yes, partially.
Do you want to explain the way that she physically hurt you?
Well, it's in the books. There was, systematic. I don't know if it's systematic. Hammer, electrical outlet, knife.
Sounds pretty horrible.
It wasn't too good. been in treatment since I was 19 and I'm 56. So that's a couple of bucks and a long time.
Yeah, you're right. When I was 5, I was overwhelmed with the sense that I was surrounded by evil. When the sun started to go down in the late afternoon, I was filled with foreboding and everything was scary. The walls, the furniture, the rug, the very air was scary. Do you think that's because you were afraid of to be in your own home? You were afraid of your mother?
I think that's because I wasn't liked at all.
By your parents?
On any level. And sure, I mean, even as a child, I mean, they say children are intelligent and on some level they sense things. I mean, certainly I knew that when nighttime came, things could happen there. I think I would like to point out that I put in what I remember, and I don't remember a lot. I've received a mix of treatment over the years. I think that it was very helpful, and this is, you know, my story and what I remember about it, and, you know, I hope readers get something out of it.
I think the story I found most surprising in your book is the night that you were preparing to do a Bush-Gore presidential debate with Will Ferrell as Bush, and this is like a really famous sketch that you did because it's where mm-hmm. Will Ferrell first does strategery and where you first mm-hmm. do lockbox with Gore mm-hmm. talking about he wanted Social Security mm-hmm. safe in a lockbox. Mm-hmm. So meanwhile, before the sketch, you're backstage in the dressing room, uh-huh. preparing to go on. Uh-huh. The floor turns red. You forget what Gore's voice sounds like. You forget what
yes.
Gore even looks like. Could you describe what you were experiencing?
I don't know if I can describe it any better than that. I mean, I was disoriented and frightened, and I was feeling every single thing that happened to me, you know, when I was in the kitchen once with my mother. And I'm not a doctor, so I can't describe what flashbacks are as well as perhaps they can, but it is like you're living it again. So if you make a small cut, it creates a new and more manageable crisis than the one that currently has you lying.
Let me stop there. You're talking about cutting yourself.
Yeah.
With a razor.
Mm-hmm.
So I interrupted you. You're saying it does what?
Well, it creates a smaller, more manageable crisis than the one that has you gripping the carpet.
So, like, the physical pain distracts you from the mental agony.
I think so. I think that might be a fair assessment of it, yeah.
So you take out a razor and start cutting your...
I don't start. It's just enough to, you know, draw red and create a crisis that's manageable, you know?
So are you concerned at that moment, what if I bleed on stage?
No,
I've been doing it
at that point. I've been doing that since I was 19 years old, so I'm pretty good at managing it.
So that you don't really show blood?
Not through my clothes. I mean, it's easily bandaged.
Got it. Okay. So, mm-hmm. So did that help? Did it help you pull it together before going on stage?
It did. And then the genius writer Jim Downey did the line readings for me in the gore in which we had discussed, which was sort of an amalgam of the two or three different presentations I'd seen of him. I found that he spoke differently on three different occasions, and we were confounded by that in about, you know, for about a year. And so we tried to find some amalgam of those three, so people say, well, that sounds exactly like him. Well, it doesn't sound like him at all. It seems to, but that's not him. It's an amalgam that I worked out in Greenwich Village in front of the audiences at the Comedy Cellar, which they finally began to respond to.
So let me back up a second. So did Jim Downey, who's doing the line readings for you, did he know what was going on with you?
No. No.
Did anybody know?
I mean, there were only really a couple of instances where people did know. I mean, most of the time it was really manageable. But if you had, you know, a pint of Remy to the occasion, then sometimes it gets a little messy.
So you go on stage,
uh-huh.
And you do the sketch.
Yes, he says, I forget what he said, what Chris Parnell, was playing Jim Lehrer, says. And then Downey is standing right in front of me. We've been doing these line readings for about 90 minutes, 60 minutes. And I say, GM, and start, you know. And once I pulled that trigger, I was able to do it. I mean, it wasn't nearly as much pressure as I've been under in my life. It wasn't nearly as much.
Mm-hmm. So did you enjoy it once you were out there?
It was exhilarating because when I did, I think the line was something like, Jim, I was about 10 seconds into the line, and there was a smattering of applause in the crowd. And some laughter, as I think, just a little bit of laughter, and I had a sense that, wow, yeah, we've worked on this for a year, here it is, and they're responding, and it was exactly what I wanted to happen.
So, you know, you had been in the dressing room, like flashing uh-huh. back to your mother abusing you, uh-huh. really uh-huh. upset. You cut yourself to mm-hmm. kind of get yourself out of your mental crisis into mm-hmm. like the physical world and into the moment. Uh-huh.
Yes.
You go on stage, you do the Bush Gore thing with Will Ferrell. That week, you end up in rehab, right?
I didn't go to rehab that week. I had been in the psych ward at one of New York's hospitals that week, though.
And again, did the people on the show know that?
I don't know how much they knew. I know that some did. I know that the power brokers did. I know they were extremely helpful to me. I know they made considered decisions over whether or not I was going to be able to put the ball over the fence, whether it was jeopardizing my health or actually helping me to have this giant project to pour my life into. And so that was a delicate balance for them and not one that they deserved to have to go through, but I thought they were very brave about it.
It sounded like they were very generous to you.
Extremely.
So you're most famous for doing Clinton on Saturday mm-hmm. Night Live. Mm-hmm. How did you go about studying Bill Clinton?
Well, the first time I looked at him, something occurred to me that seemed impossible to me, and yet I've learned a great deal from it since then in studying other people, and that is that people have people they admire. People, stand-up comics are influenced by their heroes, baseball players by their heroes. You know, we have a style that we developed that on some level is a tribute to the people we admired. I didn't know anything about him, and I thought, was this guy into Kennedy or something? I don't know why I thought that. Why am I feeling Kennedy? I'm feeling Kennedy. And I was just, it was an instinctual thing. I mean, it's not like what I do is an exact science, and I'm frequently wrong. I hasten to add that. But finally, I couldn't get a handle on it. I mean, I couldn't get a handle on it all. So I thought, I had audio recording somewhere of JFK's inaugural address. I printed it out by hand. I rehearsed it with a Southern accent, and then I put in this little crackle in my voice that I'd heard him do, and voila, I felt like I had him.
Now, you point out that Clinton, that most people have like 4 or 5 hand gestures that they use, whereas Clinton had about 37. So did you catalog his different hand gestures?
I tried to, but then, I realized at that point, no one's going to know that. No one's going to remember all. They're not going to care about, here's this fascinating man. You know, no one will respond to that. So I thought that at that point, and this is very early in my career at SNL, I thought to myself, I think I'm going to just pick 2 or 3 that I find interesting. Then I'm going to take them down to Greenwich Village and put them up on stage and see what they respond to. So one night I was on stage there, and I bit my lower lip, and I held up my thumb like, to give the, I don't know what that sign is, where you like give the thumbs up sign at the same time, and people went wild. They thought that was him, and I thought, again, this is what people are responding to, but I never saw him do them both at the same time. I brought it out there. They responded it to in the Village. I showed it to Lauren. He said, that's it. That's what we want. I mean, because we were starting out as accurately as we could get, but then we were italicizing, too. I mean, are you familiar with the artist Hirschfeld?
The caricaturist.
Yes.
Who had all those famous caricatures in the New York Times.
Yes, I used to put those pictures in my office and try to absorb them and think about them, like, what was that man doing? Because that's what I want to do. I mean, Bob Hope's nose wasn't that long, was it? I mean,
no.
Really? Judy Garland's nose didn't pug that much, did it? Well, we don't know what that means, but we respond to it like, wow, yeah, that's them. That's really them. So, Lauren's formula was always start with the accurate thing and then italicize. And then it makes it glorious and it shows that all the person's colors, and the people respond to it better than a simple print.
Now, you did John McCain. I think it was like your last season on Saturday Night Live. And
yeah.
So you did McCain opposite Tina Fey, Sarah Palin, when like everybody was watching. But you didn't want to do McCain.
No.
Would you explain
not after.
Why? Yeah.
Well, my father and I had never been close on any level for, 40 something years. He was dying of cancer. He was in a hospice, and we got a call on a Saturday. I was doing a show that night with Obama, future President Obama, and I called and I said, look, I will skip tonight's show and I'll come straight down there. And he said, I think that in case this guy's the president, you should have this honor of being on stage with him. And I said, okay. So he took himself off his morphine. He was afraid the morphine would stop his liver or his heart or something, because, by then he'd had his ear cut off and really savage pain. So he takes himself off the morphine. I fly to Florida the following morning with my pal Eddie, who's ex-NYPD and who my father, I think, truly loved. And we get there to the hospice, and, there's a few hours left to his life, And we get there, we walk in the room, and he had arrayed his war medals on his chest. And it was as if to say, I guess I wasn't such a great dad. You know? And I took that as an apology. Sorry.
You're saying that he was saying to you, maybe I wasn't such a great dad, but I was a really good soldier?
He was saying, it took my life. It took my heart. It took my soul. I went there. I became a warrior. I killed people. And I had a hard time, you know, adjusting to society after that.
So getting back to McCain, you didn't want to portray McCain because...
Well, we had a military funeral. There were soldiers. They played taps. There was a folded flag. And it was, I think, the single most... Yeah, I have to... Just give me a second.
Sure. However much time you want.
It was the single most important thing that had ever happened to me in my whole life. The single most.
That funeral?
Yes, because... I realized, you know, I had seen him through the years grappling with these visions of what he called verifiable evil. I mean, maybe not biblical, but not of this earth. When he looked into the eyes of one particular Nazi officer who... God, sorry. He took his gun, you know?
Your father...
Which is...
Your father took the Nazi's gun or his own gun?
His gun, the Nazi's gun,
uh-huh.
and brought it home.
Right.
And I guess I was about 12, and he was sitting in the living room, just hammered, you know, on gin, and staring out, as he was wont to do, into his tomato garden, through the glass doors. I need to take a tranquilizer before I do these interviews. And I was like, what in the world? Why would you have a German Luger? I mean, it wasn't loaded. There was never any idea that it was going to be shot at anybody or anything. I was just like, wow, that's a real gun. And he said, he said that it was particularly humiliating to have your gun taken from you if you were an officer. He said he looked into this man's eyes. The man looked at him with such joy and triumph of evil. Then he didn't say, then I killed him. I mean, it's quite obvious they killed him. I'd heard him talk about people that he killed, and I was like, why now? Why are you looking at it? And he said, I took his gun. I'm stone cold sober and I'm sitting here feeling this. This is crazy. He said, I wanted him to see in my eyes my response to what I saw in his eyes when I took his gun. He would say, look, these aren't normal people. They're not going through a phase. This is luscious, evil, joy, triumph. They weren't normal people, you know. Now, having said that, here's a guy who's afraid to go to church. Killed a lot of guys.
Is that what you mean when you say in your book that you think that the war, like, ruined him?
Well, to the extent that he couldn't really function that well except as a warrior. Mm-hmm. That's what he became. My experience is you become a warrior, it's pretty tough to convert. You know, it's tough to look into the eyes of an SS officer on Friday and pump gas in Mississippi on Monday. It's not easy.
I'm thinking about you being a boy in your house, and on the one hand, your mother sticking your fingers into electric sockets,
yeah,
and coming after you with a knife, and, you know, making you think that maybe you were evil, or that
yes,
she was evil, or that there was evil dwelling in the house. You were afraid to be home. And yeah, at the same time, your father's talking to you about this, like, evil Nazi and who he had, yeah, to kill, and he still has the gun, and he has, like, evidence of that man in your house.
Yeah.
So I could see how you'd grow up.
Do you understand how he
scared.
Was haunted by?
Yeah.
He was
yeah,
haunted yeah. every night of his life by what he saw.
But I think I also hear how you were haunted by him being haunted.
Yeah.
So just to finish where we got into this from, you didn't want to do John McCain because you didn't want to
because
mock someone who'd been a prisoner of war and had come.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. His, it was my, I mean, look, if you're injured, it changes the way you move. If you're injured, it changes the way you talk. I didn't want to lampoon someone, you know, who'd given his life.
Someone who'd been through that ordeal.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what really troubled me reading your book?
What?
You know, you're talking about, like, how your mother, like, physically abused you and otherwise didn't pay a whole lot of attention to you and that, yeah. you know, your father was so obsessed with, like, what happened during the war and you felt that that broke him. And, like, you're having all this trouble. Like, you're at home, you're cutting yourself, you're having serious psychological problems. And it sounds from your memoir, unless you left this part out, that they didn't really try to help you. They didn't even try to understand what you were going through.
No, they never did. They were happy to accept, as I am happy to accept, a sanitized version of reality. If I can get a sanitized version of reality, I'll take it, you know? So I go to this doctor in Sebastian, Florida. The guy interviews me, and he doesn't know what the hell he's dealing with. I mean, he doesn't know. I mean, how can he in 1 hour? So he says to my mother, I mean, he says, he's a schizophrenic and he's a manic depressive. And she, I can remember, I saw her face. She said, oh, like she thought she was about ready to get busted. And instead she's like, really? Is that right? Yeah. Well, what can we do about that? The doctor says, well, I'll just give him these pills. That's right. And then we'll lock him up here for a while and that'll be just fine. So they were happy to accept that as that's what happened. And my father doesn't know what happened at all. I mean, really, he's in his own world. And so years later, when I began trauma therapy, I called her on the phone and I said, I'm being treated for the symptoms that prisoners of war happened, Mom, but all I did was grow up in your house. Can you talk to me about that? There was a pause, and then a sort of that husky, throaty thing she got in when she was about ready to menace. She said, don't ever call us again. Click. Like that. And that I didn't talk to them until their deathbed.
Did you always remember these things about your mother?
No.
Or did they come out in...
I remember her reciting the Little Orphan Annie poem about Little Orphan Annie being butchered. I remembered that. I remember the floor being red and me bleeding in a vague sense. Not a lot about it. I remember. I thought it was my fault. I remember my hand slammed in the door. Again, my fault. And also electric socket. It's my fault. All my fault, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine the desperation of a child who chooses to believe that he did this to himself just so he doesn't have to consider the idea that his mother did it or his parents did it? Because, you know, Terry, I'll tell you something. I hope this... I don't know anything about you, but I think it's completely barbaric to shake hands with and seek help from the person who caused your injury. That will make you sick. That's my idea. And I'm not a doctor, okay? If a doctor comes in here and goes, you know what, you're completely wrong, I'll go, yeah, you're right, I'm a nut.
You don't have any questions about these memories? Like, you're confident that your mother did this, that it's not... Like,
yes. Mm. That's the little bit that I remember, yes.
So let me say something that I think you got from your mother that was positive. Maybe the only thing, but let's talk about this thing. And that is that she really liked to do impressions of people in the neighborhood.
Yes.
And the way, maybe the only way that you had to connect with her was doing impressions too, which is how you started doing impressions.
Yes.
So who were those early people who you did impressions of?
We did, in those days, we were doing Ralph Richardson and Paul Scofield and a record they had of A Christmas Carol in which they played most of the characters. So we would do those words. I mean, I think I put some of that in the book. After that, as I started to get up around the age of 10, I could do a little Popeye scat singing, you know. I knew vowels and consonants then. And you know, when he was like, skeet-a-bit-a-dos, get-a-bit-a-get-a-bit-a-bit-a-get-a-do, you know, I worked that out of my head, you know. I mean, I didn't have a lot to do, you know. So I worked that out of my head. Well, that I don't want to say delighted her or charmed her or changed our relationship. I can tell you that on a given day, it changed her state. When she got that faraway look in her eyes, when her southern accent fell, when her voice grew husky, I knew what was happening then. So, let's do A Christmas Carol, Mom. Or let's play, she used to play Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, you know, a wonderful piece. And we would sometimes play that. I couldn't play the whole thing. She could play the whole thing. I could just play like the first 60 seconds of it. Well, all of a sudden, the afternoon's over and everything's fine. I could remember she was doing someone from the neighborhood. I just remember doing that voice when she left the room. I was like, wow, I think I can do that.
How did you start getting serious about your ability to do impressions and think, okay, I can make this a real part of my life?
I was 27. I had done 5 or 6 plays, I forget, in New York City. And I got tired of the life. It was too hard. Being a waiter, I mean, and then doing a play at night, really, really hard. So I thought, well, I'm not fit for anything else. What do I like? And then I thought, well, I like talking like other people. That's fun. So I moved to Florida. One thing led to another. Bop, bop, bop. I'm in a radio station, midnight to 6, punching buttons 3 times an hour, and I have 6 hours a night to practice in a recording studio. And I start trying to improve myself. A year later, I got a job at a radio station doing character voices, and then it sort of took off.
Did it help you to be able to listen back to yourself by recording yourself?
It did, but I never do that now.
Why not?
I just—it's disturbing to me because I noticed it'd be like if you were a violin player and you listen to a recording yourself and you kind of hit the note. I mean, I don't feel like any of them. I very seldom think any of them are any good. I know it's a trick, you know, it's a vocal trick I'm doing, and I never thought they were any good, most of them.
Well, apparently you're the only one who thought that.
Well, thank you.
So, in your book, you describe how, like, you're going to do your audition for Lorne Michaels and for Marcy, what's her name?
Klein.
Marcy Klein, who, like, first discovered you at a club.
Yes.
And thought, like, let's give him an audition. And you're already taking lithium for the problems that you're having.
Right. And you can see that bloat in my first White House Correspondents' Dinners, yes.
From the lithium?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, when you get the job... You got the job. Did you feel like, I'm hiding something from them by not telling them that I'm having these problems, I'm on lithium?
You know, if you look back in the book, I sat down in the chair, and Lorne Michaels, whose eyes don't miss things too often, I would imagine, looked at me in the eyes for a second and knew that he'd seen a creature like me before. Okay? He looked at me, a look of recognition. And he said, are you okay? Are you all right? I mean, why would he say that? I mean, I'm sure he didn't say that to everyone that auditioned for him. He knew exactly what he was seeing. He'd seen it before. And I think that when I was doing Ted Koppel in German, or Phil Donahue in Spanish, I forget, I saw him another look of recognition. And it was pleasing to him. And I did well enough that he called me back to give me another hard workout, which I did a second audition. So I was very, very honored.
So earlier we were talking about how cutting yourself with a razor or a knife got you out of your emotional pain, out of your head, and
Well, I think it made me manageable. It got me up off the floor, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does working do that too? Does like studying voices, doing impressions, get you out of what's happening in your head also?
So does reading books, taking walks, watching baseball. I love baseball. I've just decided to let the larger issues of life go to the Einsteins and the Billy Grahams. I failed at so much stuff. I love baseball again, and that's what I do.
So, you know, we've talked about some horrible things in your life, you know, emotional pain, drug problems, cutting yourself. Where are you now?
Well, I was on 7 meds when I was on Saturday Night Live. I'm on 1, you know, Wellbutrin, which is, I think, some of the healthiest people I know take Wellbutrin.
It's a very commonly used antidepressant.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a general principle. The point is that due to this, the great doctors I've met and some of the spiritual laws that I find miraculous in groups, look, I've been at it a long time. I don't have flashbacks anymore. I don't have nightmares anymore. I don't cut. And I feel good most of the time. I mean, I really have a nice thing going. It just took a long time to get here, you know?
Well, I wish you well. I wish you good health.
And the same to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Daryl Hammond's new memoir is called God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Effed. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, The Anatomy of Skyscrapers. This is Fresh Air. Skyscrapers are no longer rare, and they're no longer an American phenomenon, but they're still remarkable, as if just staying up weren't amazing enough. As my guest Kate Asher writes, these giant buildings function as vertical cities, providing infrastructure and services to thousands of people at enormous heights. Her new book, The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper, explains everything from how skyscrapers are built to what happens after a toilet on a high floor is flushed. Her previous book, The Works, was about the infrastructure that supports daily life in New York City. She's on the faculty of Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation, and is a consulting engineer running the urban planning section at Happold Consulting. Kate Asher, welcome to Fresh Air. Love the book. I have to tell you, it made me a little nervous. Because my theory is when you're in a skyscraper, especially if you're on the higher floors, you don't even want to think about how it's designed and how it manages to stay up without collapsing and how the plumbing works. You just want to have faith. Faith that it all stays up, that it all works. And reading your book and actually reading about the design, you think like, oh my God, how do they do that? So I'm not even sure what my question is for this, but I guess you know both. You know how it works and you also have faith it's going to stay up.
Well, I do, but I was like you, not totally comfortable on high floors of skyscrapers, except I would occasionally hear them moving and worry about that movement. And I guess part of the motivation to do the book was actually to figure out what was going on there and whether that was supposed to be the case or not.
Well, while we're on the subject, you talk about how there's two kinds of weight impacting on a skyscraper. One is the weight of one floor on top of the other, on top of the other, on top of the other. You say that's the easy part. The really hard part is all the wind forces that push on the skyscraper from different ends. Why is the wind pressure so difficult an engineering problem?
Well, it's an interesting question that you ask, because the gravity loads, which one assumes are the heaviest weights upon a building, as a building gets taller, don't multiply nearly as fast as what are called the lateral loads or the wind loads, as you note. And that's really a function of just the size and the height as you move up, because there are wind currents that when we're down below, we just don't even notice. And that building, as it rises, interrupts those flows, and they push harder and harder. The larger the building, the greater the wind flows. You can moderate them in some ways by shaping your building to take advantage of those flows better or worse, but they're still going to be there.
So skyscrapers are built to sway back and forth with the wind. Why does swaying help?
If a building weren't able to move at the top, then various structural elements might be damaged because of the wind pressure. So most skyscrapers will be designed to move at the top, and some, particularly in earthquake zones, will actually be designed to be able to move a little bit on their foundations as well, so they don't take as much pressure as they would do if they were absolutely firm and static.
Say on the 100th story of a skyscraper, how much sway is there?
It's not a precise formula in terms of the amount of sway in a building, but there is a maximum, and it's about 1/500th of the building's height is the maximum permitted sway. The minute you get more of that, it's not that the building's going to crack or fall over. It's that people who are actually in the building themselves as tenants or residents will start feeling a little bit queasy.
Now, you described the Comcast Center, a pretty new skyscraper in Philadelphia, has the largest tuned liquid damper to do what?
The dampers on top of buildings help counteract the sway. So if you imagine that the wind's pushing a skyscraper in one direction, a damper, whether it's water or made of some other material, will push the building the other way to try to counteract the sway that's coming from the wind.
I'm trying to picture how it would do that.
Well, if you think about a tank of water, because the liquid dampers are really tanks of water, or a pool on top of a building, as the wind comes from one direction, it will push the building in that direction, but the water, of course, will go to the other side. So that weight of water moving to the other side, almost like a wave, will counteract the wind pressure and help the building stay in one place, as it were.
One of the great architectural paradoxes of our time is that these skyscrapers that have all glass sides and it looks like just window after window, the windows don't open. So they don't really function in that way as windows. So if you're in this huge skyscraper of 100 stories or more, how do you get air to circulate through the building and keep that air fresh and not just recirculate horrible air with lots of bacteria and germs and other terrible things?
Right. You can imagine if you didn't circulate the air, you'd have people getting sick very, very quickly. There are huge mechanical floors on these skyscrapers that really do nothing but change out air and water. And that air is continuously being changed out and exhausted into the environment. So air is taken in, cleaned, conditioned, cooled, heated, and then exhausted into the building. There are some new buildings now that are actually exhausting cleaner air than the air they take in. But it's a constant process, and it happens around the clock.
So let me ask a question that I think everybody really wants to know. When you're on the 100th floor of a building and you flush the toilet, what exactly happens after that?
It's not that different than a house. The water from the toilet goes down a series of pipes and eventually will end up in some kind of septic system, usually a municipal sewer. But it's the same system that operates in many homes that are plugged into to city sewer systems. It's just a longer way for the waste to travel.
Well, if waste travels 100 stories, doesn't it start to travel with incredible speed? Wouldn't it speed up the greater distance it's falling down?
It does. There are very sophisticated bends in the pipes and air that's let in to slow the water as it's moving through. You don't want to hear it as it's moving through the building, so you need to make sure that it's soundproofed as well. And these mechanical floors.
I hadn't even thought of that.
Right. Well, you probably have heard of radiators banging. That's water moving through the pipes in buildings for heat. And so you can have the same issue with its water moving out of a building. So you really want to make sure of that. There are some buildings that actually reuse what's called gray water or dirty water. And that's increasingly being seen in what are called green buildings to minimize water usage, not for drinking, but for other functions within a building. But typically in most skyscrapers, that drainage goes right into a city system.
You write that there are safety features in other countries that are better than ours and that our skyscrapers have fewer safety regulations or more lenient safety regulations that they have to comply with. Give us a sense of what's being done in some other countries safety-wise that we're not doing.
Well, there's different materials in different places, for a start, but there are also escape floors that they're also called floors of refuge in many of the Asian buildings. And they're places where people are asked to go in a fire or other kind of emergency as opposed to coming all the way out of the building. They're asked to assemble at the refuge floors, and then there are sometimes express elevators that will take them from those floors, or they're asked to stay there until the emergency has passed. And so you have separate air systems for those buildings so that the people can theoretically survive in an emergency instead of trying to get all the way out of a very tall building. Because as we know from the Trade Center experience, it can take hours for a really tall skyscraper to empty itself of its people.
And so compare that to what we typically have in American skyscrapers.
Well, in American skyscrapers, there are building codes that, you know, explain how many stairways you need to have and the width of stairways and the lighting of stairways. There are also procedures for evacuating them, and people do fire and emergency drills all the time. But at the moment, when there is a fire or other emergency in a skyscraper, the typical reaction is not to use the elevators. It's simply to assemble and to have an orderly move out based on whoever is controlling that evacuation. Not everybody needs to evacuate, but certainly the floors above a fire are usually asked to evacuate. Different cities have different procedures, but typically elevators are not used in a fire situation to evacuate people, whereas they are. There are separate sets of elevators that may be used to do that in Europe and in parts of Asia.
So what is currently the tallest building in the world?
The tallest building in the world is a mixed-use building that opened in Dubai last year called the Burj Khalifa, which holds hotel, office, and residential accommodation.
And how many stories is that?
It's about 140 stories, I believe. It may be 160. It's about 2,700 feet tall, so it's very, very tall.
Have you been in it?
I haven't been in it. The last time I was in Dubai, it was only 115 stories, but I couldn't see the top of it because it was in cloud. So I'm looking forward to going back and seeing if I can make it on the observation deck elevators all the way to the top, which for somebody who doesn't like heights is, should prove quite a challenge.
Right. So, you know, you write that in Dubai, they don't have like a sewage infrastructure to support high-rises like this one. So what do they do with the sewage?
A variety of buildings there. Some can access the municipal system, but many of them actually use trucks to take the sewage out of individual buildings, and then they wait on a queue to put it into a wastewater treatment plant. So it's a fairly primitive system.
Well, these trucks can wait for hours and hours online.
That's right. I'm told they can wait up to 24 hours before they get to the head of the queue. Now, there is a municipal system that is being invested in, and I assume will connect all of these tall buildings at some point in the near future. But they're certainly not alone. In India, many buildings are responsible for providing their own water and their own wastewater removal. So it's really – we're very fortunate in this country that we assume we can plug into an urban system that can handle whatever waste the building produces. That's not the case everywhere else in the world.
Well, it really illustrates one of the paradoxes of modern life, that we have these just incredible structures that reach, you know, that seem to reach to the sky. And then in a place like Dubai, you have a 24-hour-long line of trucks waiting to dispose of the waste from those buildings.
Right. Well, it's, you know, you have to remember that a place like Dubai really emerged in the last 50 years. It was a sleepy, you know, Bedouin town half a century ago. And what you do is when you bring in the world's, you know, most sophisticated architects and engineers, you can literally build anything, including a building of 140 or 150 stories. But designing a municipal network of sewage treatment is in some ways more complex, certainly requires more money and more time to make it happen. So one just seemed to jump ahead of the other.
So there are new skyscrapers now that are mixed-use skyscrapers. So they combine offices, residential space, stores. So what are some of the stresses on a building like that compared to the more traditional just like office skyscraper?
It's a little bit harder to design those buildings because what you have is different flows of people coming in at different times of day who don't always want to run into each other. So you'll often have a premium hotel that might sit on top of an office block with a variety of retail shops down below, and you don't want your hotel guests, particularly if they're being charged a pretty penny, running into your workaday folks coming in out of the office at lunchtime. And so you really need to segregate entrances and exits. You need to make sure that not everybody's moving in and out at the same time of day, because it can also get very, very crowded. And then you'll also have residential accommodation at higher levels in some of these buildings, and those folks use a different schedule entirely. So you have different entrances and you have different elevatoring because you have different elevator systems that are going to move to serve each of those markets. So it's a very complicated design process.
And then just technically, there's a different amount of floor space that's required for office buildings than for residential space.
Right, and they tend to often work together. Offices tend to be bigger and need to be more open, so with less walls, because you need, you know, space for conference rooms and various things which you don't have in homes. Homes, of course, you want as much window exposure as possible because people don't want to live in rooms without windows. So they tend to have smaller footprints or floor plates. So what you'll frequently see nowadays is an office podium down below a residential tower on top, with the tower being skinnier, of course, than the podium office, because you need to have those windows very close to each room. And that seems to be the most popular configuration at the moment.
Kate Asher, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kate Asher is the author of the new book, The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper. You can see a slideshow of images from her book on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and join us on Facebook. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.